This episode of Literary Treks is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and to help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. And if you want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode, join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Taking all these books?
I thought I'd take some light reading in case I got bored.
Welcome to Literary Treks number 229, your official Star Trek books and comic show here on the Trek FM network. And I am just one of your hosts, Bruce Gibson. And with me, as he always is, with book in hand, Dan Gunther. Hey, Dan, how's it going?
Not too bad. Really happy to be here, as usual, Bruce. And yeah, book in hand, raring to go.
Well, you've had a busy week because you were at the Calgary Expo. Tell us about that.
I have, yeah. So the Calgary Expo, it's the Calgary Comic and Entertainment Expo is the full name.
That's just too long.
Well, it's funny because I went there as media for the first time this year, and they very explicitly say you have to call it the Calgary Expo or the Calgary Comic and Entertainment Expo. Heaven forbid you ever say Comic-Con. That is definitely out. Do not call it that. But yeah, it was great fun. There were a few Star Trek people there, and I actually did get a chance to interview very briefly for about a minute and a half Garrett Wong, who played Harry Kim, of course, on Voyager. So can check that out on my YouTube channel. I'll have it up by the time this episode goes up. So that was exciting. I was incredibly nervous, as I'm sure you'll be able to tell on the video.
Oh, cool. I can't wait to check that out. That reminds me. So I had lunch with David R. George III, who's a Star Trek author, for those who don't know. And he lives locally here. And I was telling him something about Garrett Wong. And I said, you know, the guy who played, and I had a brain fart.
Oh,
and
no.
he's like, Harry Kim. And I was like, yeah, Harry Kim. He just looks at me with this grin like, come on, you can do better than that. And I'm like, I feel so bad. How did I not get that? I mean, I love Voyager, and it's not that I don't know. You know, you just have those brain farts, you know? Mm-hmm.
Those ones that, like, you know, two more of these and I really have to turn in my Trekkie card. Yeah.
Right. I'm like, I can't do that. I can't do that now. I got to be on point. I got to be on top of things. So speaking of point, I want to ask you a quick question. This has something to do with literature in a sense. This is about writing. So I am over the age of 40, just because that pertains to the story. So someone posted the other day on Facebook about, you know, for those who are over 40, you don't need to double space between sentences. Because when I was growing up, apparently, when typewriters are being used, you were told to double space. But now, the way the letters work, they're more proportional to each other and not monospace. So the spacing nowadays, when you type on computers, allows you to not have to double space between sentences, but single space. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, I always single space in Twitter because I'm saving character space. But I just want to know from you, Dan, what do you know about, do you double space or single space between sentences?
You know, what's funny is growing up, even though it was mostly word processors we used, there was never a typewriter in my school. I was after that. But we were always taught to double space as well. So I was just plugging along, happily double spacing my way through life. And then I saw on Facebook, probably about 3 or 4 years ago, some author somewhere railing against, you know, the fact that people still double space and it's supposed to be single space now and it looks awful. And I kind of, oh, and quietly filed that in my mind and started single spacing since then. And it's actually kind of funny. If you look at my blog, my book review blog, it's all double spaced up until a certain day and then it's all single spaced. Oh, wow. So I'd be curious myself to look back and see what exactly that date was that I switched over. But yeah, no, I was always taught to double space, and that was even on computers. So,
well, you know, I don't have a recent novel in front of me right now, which is really odd. I just want to look at a novel and see if it looks single spaced or double spaced. But yeah, it's single spaced. Wow. Okay. Anyway, I'm single spaced from here on out, just so you know.
Yeah. And like I said, the same thing happened to me. I was just like, oh, I didn't know. And then I just changed. And yeah, apparently Facebook, even when people do double space and then they hit post, it automatically single spaces it all. I could be wrong about that, but I heard that Facebook just fixes that.
Interesting. I'll have to check that out too. Interesting. Well, that's not what we're all here to talk about. That's part of what we wanted to talk about. But we do have a feature coming up later in the show, DS9 novel. An early one called Fallen Heroes, and it's by David Abhugh. I don't know if I said that correctly.
I think it's actually Daveth, I believe.
There's a thith?
Yeah, it's a Welsh name, I believe.
Okay, Daveth Abhugh. I don't know.
It's odd.
But anyway, that's coming up in the feature later, so we're going to talk about some Deep Space Nine, Fallen Heroes. And we have Brandon Shea Matala, who's going to join us in that segment. And of course, he's a Trek FM host here on some other shows on the network. But before we do that, we do have a comic we want to review. And I'm very sentimental about this one because this is Star Trek Boldly Go number 18. And it's significant, not because it's number 18, but because number 18 is the last issue of the Boldly Go series. So pull out your tissues, wipe your eyes. The series is done, and we're going to cover that last issue. And this is actually part six of the Idik line arc that we've had in the last, of course, now six issues.
Yeah.
So sad.
Agreed. It's I kind of want to sing some Sarah McLachlan or something here, but I don't know if our rights will cover a lot of that song.
I don't think our rights would cover you singing, period.
I think we don't have enough liability insurance taken out on our listeners' ears for that, so.
True. Well, you know, I'm not going to get too sad because I've been down this road before. Issue number 60 of Star Trek Ongoing was the last issue, and I was all upset. And then like 2 or 3 months later, they're like, oh, we're coming out with Boldly Go, and we're picking right back up with the Kelvin timeline stuff. It's like, oh, they're just kind of starting over again. So I don't know anything at this point. I'm just saying we may see the Kelvin timeline again in comic form. But as of right now, this is the last issue for a while.
Yeah. And as Sarah Gato said when we talked to her, people love an issue number one. So, you know, a lot of times comic lines will do this and just kind of start a new series and say, oh, this is issue number one of the new series. So again, like you say, we don't know. There's no word on if that's happening, but I wouldn't be surprised. I would not be surprised at all.
Well, I would be a little surprised only because in the previous issue, there was mention that they're getting ready to get back to the Enterprise A, that it's done. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know if Paramount will allow them to go that route because they may be starting on the Enterprise A in the next movie. We don't know yet because they don't know exactly what they're doing with the movie at this point. And maybe they do, but anyway, there's also a variant cover of this issue that shows Kirk, Spock, and Uhura looking at the Enterprise A in space dock as if it's getting ready to go on its voyage soon. So that almost makes it feel like it's the end.
Yeah, I thought we'd get some of that in the story. I thought they'd, you know, at least get to the point where they're getting ready to get on the ship by the end. But we don't really get that in this story. So that was a little surprising to me.
Yeah, and unless Paramount says, you know what, guys, go ahead and start a new series on the A, because the next movie is not going to pick up on their first voyage on the A. And I would be thrilled to see that in comic form. Like, that, you know,
yeah.
It's called Star Trek, Kelvin Timeline Enterprise A. No, that's a little too long. That's almost as long as the Calvary Expo title.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, to be fair, Star Trek Beyond ended with the Enterprise finished and leaving space dock. So, you know, we know the crew is out there flying around past some closing credits. So I don't think it would be that big. It certainly wouldn't be as big of a stretch than if during the DC run at the end of Star Trek III, they introduced an Enterprise A in the comics and had them fly off on it. Like, that would be, they weren't able to do that because, of course, that hadn't happened yet and we wouldn't get that till Star Trek IV. But they still found a way to do adventures, kind of like the Boldly Go series. But the Enterprise A is out there and we've seen it fly off. So I don't think it would be a huge stretch to say, oh, we're on our shakedown cruise. That's what the new comic series is.
Hopefully we'll see that. I'm hoping for that, but
that would be pretty cool.
We'll see. But let's, this issue again is the last in this series, but also the last of this Idic arc. And we start things off where we see Kirk with Gary Mitchell, and they both have that godlike stuff going on with them, and their eyes all sparkly and almost sounds like it's a, you know, like a fashion show, sparkly. I don't know what I'm talking about.
Well, and I love the way it starts because I feel like this was a line that was written for William Shatner's Kirk, and I think he would probably be sad that he never got to say it. Captain's log, supplemental. I'm a god now. Like, that's just so Kirk. Like, that's perfect.
I think William Shatner used to say that in the mirror to himself.
I would believe it.
Well, what's cool about how this starts off is they both have this godlike thing going on and they're playing the 3D chess game with each other. And the characters, the little, you know, what do you call them? The
pawns,
the pieces,
I guess.
The pawns, pieces, that's yeah. It. Oh my gosh. The pawns are the characters from the different ships, from the Enterprises. And in the previous issues, what we saw is all these different universes of Enterprise crew members. So we saw, you know, Kirk, we saw a female Kirk, we saw a Kirk that grew up as a Klingon. He's not a Klingon, but he was raised by Klingons, or he grew up on Kronos. We saw the crew as trees, as metal people, like all kinds of things. And so this is that last story to that. And so we see less of all these different crew members. They're still in here, but we're not seeing as much as we saw in the other ones. The focus of this story is really on Kirk and Gary and them playing against each other. And the different crew members, we see them live in different situations on different planets relating to one another, but they're really being played by Kirk and Gary.
Yeah, I liked that kind of conceit of the story. So, like you say, Kirk and Gary are playing this three-dimensional chess, and the moves that they make in the game are echoed by what's happening to the characters in the rest of the story. So, it almost made me want to launch into a whole thing in my brain about free will versus, you know, fate or destiny and being controlled by an outside power. But I don't want to get that deep into it because then I start kind of freaking out about stuff. But yeah, it's a really interesting story and the pieces get moved around in new and interesting ways. And to me, what is really interesting is the way it ends. And I have, I don't know, some mixed feelings about that.
So what, you're not talking about the last page, are you? Or
no, because the last page is what turned my mind around about my mixed feelings. But, you know, it just seems very abrupt, the ending to the actual action and how it goes down. It's kind of one of those things where I'm not sure how they could have ended it otherwise, but it's very, I don't know, it seems to happen very quickly that.
Yeah, I agree. It's I like this issue better than the previous ones in this arc. I like the previous issue better than the other four. I think the first four, it was just weird with all these different Enterprise crew members and a female Kirk and a tree looking Kirk and all these different, you know, crew members that the Enterprise crew is just like all these weird universes. But then when we got to this point with Gary Mitchell, then it became really interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
And the focus was more on these two characters, and those other characters were kind of on the side. They're kind of the minor characters or the ones being played by these two. But yeah, when we get to the end, we see all the different Enterprises from the different universes. And I talked about this on another episode in one of the other comics. I'm a little disappointed that we have all these Enterprises from all these universes, but they all look like the Kelvin Enterprise. Like, mm-hmm. I want to see, oh, there's the TOS Enterprise from like in the TV series. And oh, there's an Enterprise that looks like a different type of Enterprise. We never, like, I want to see different Enterprises. And heck, throw even the Enterprise that we just saw at the end of Discovery in there too. That would have been really cool. But they're all Kelvin timeline Enterprises, and I'm just like, I want a little more variety. But
totally,
but
that,
that's not a big deal.
I was looking through all of the Enterprises. I'm like, okay, where's the tree Enterprise? And like, surely that one would look different, right?
Right, but, right. If all these crew all members look different, yeah, why don't the ships look different? Yeah. I mean, there's a slight variance on some, but very slight. But anyway, but yeah, the way it ends, and if nobody wants to hear, just kind of jump ahead like 5 minutes. We're not going to go too far into this. But then, you know, Kirk just basically convinces all the crew members when Gary's not paying attention just to fire at them.
Yeah, and then it's kind of like flash, and they're back on the bridge of the Endeavor, I'm assuming. And everything's back to normal and no one else remembers anything except Kirk. And it seems that like Gary could have destroyed them all, but didn't, kind of thing. Which is the one thing that I found interesting about this ending was that it seems like, you know, Gary's like, I won. I can destroy you anytime I want. And Kirk's like, you're right. We can anytime, I guess.
Yeah. I think that Gary is just wants to play against Kirk and not necessarily destroy everyone. And I think Kirk, you know, even though Gary might talk it up like he would, I think Kirk's like, you know, I know that Gary's full of crap, you know, and I'm going to call him on it. And yeah, Gary, you know, you could do anything you want. Sure, you can. Sure, you can. Go ahead. And Gary's like, ah, yeah, whatever. And then leaves, you know, like Kirk knows. Yeah, Gary's not going to do anything.
Yeah. But then the very end of this, I thought, was a really nice way to end both this story and the current Boldly Go series, which is this, you know, since Kirk has glimpsed all of these different realities, because as he said at the beginning, he was a god, he got to glimpse the reality, which I'm assuming is, if not the Prime Universe, something very close to the Prime Universe, where his father lived. And he had a relationship with his dad and learned from him and went exploring with him on his motorbike. And I thought that was really sweet. That was a really nice way to end. I was grinning by the end of this.
Same here. And I guess this is when Paramount said 2 years ago, Chris Hemsworth is coming back. They meant this issue, right?
That must be it. I think so. Yeah.
And maybe this is the Kirk's father that will come in to from this timeline and come into the Kelvin timeline movie, the fourth movie, whenever that comes out or whatever. But no, I agree with you. It was a nice way to end this arc and this story, to see that Kirk got a glimpse of himself as a young boy with his dad. That's a nice touch. However, I was a little disappointed knowing that this was the end of this line. And as you mentioned earlier, I wanted to kind of see them all returning together to get on the A, or some kind of cap to this whole 18 issue series that we got, but we didn't get that.
You know, it's just as a total little side note here. One of the guests at the Calgary Expo was Jennifer Morrison, who of course played Kirk's mother in Star Trek 2009. And Garrett Wong moderated that panel. He was the MC. And
he moderates every panel besides at Las Vegas. But anyway, go on.
He does, and he's really good at it. He clearly loves it. But
and he played what's his name on Voyager? Harry Kim.
Right. Sorry. Yeah, that guy. But this was just a little note thing that I noted. At the very start, he talked about Star Trek 2009 and how much he loved that scene, probably because he knew nobody in the audience would ask about Star Trek, because, you know, it was Jennifer Morrison. She's on Once Upon a Time. She's doing other stuff. But he brought up that scene, and there was just one moment, and he said, you know, that scene where George Kirk, your husband, he dies, and she cut in. She said, I presume dead. And he was like, right, presume dead. And then it moved on from there, and I was like, wait, what? Like, does she know something? Is she going to be in the new? Has she seen a script or something? Anyway, total speculation, but I was like, as the biggest Trekkie in that room, I'm sure my ears perked right up.
I think it would be a disservice to that movie if he survived, if George Kirk survived that scene. Because
I
that's
kind
the
of
impact
agree.
Of that scene is him dying.
That scene is the best scene in all of the Kelvin timeline, in my opinion. That is just such a moving scene, and it's brilliant. And yeah, I don't disagree with you there. Anyway, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know how they'll handle it or if they're going to do anything, but we'll see. We'll see. I have nothing else to say, but we'll see. Anyway, so we'll go right into the feature. But before we do that, I just want to mention up front. So in our Goodreads group, we've got some forums set up to talk about the series of the TNG novels, A Time To, those 9 novels. So we already reviewed A Time to Be Born, but then we've got the other 8 to do. And so if you're not a member of a Goodreads group, then go into Goodreads and look for Larry Treks and join the group. And if you're already a member, go ahead and if you're starting to read those books, post in the forum there. We have, we're going to set up each book as its own category, and you can put spoilers in. We can already start discussing the books even before an episode comes out. So feel free to do that. And so I just wanted to mention that up front.
Awesome.
So let's go in and do the feature. Where's Brandon? Brandon, come over here. Let's do this. So Brandon, I'm glad you came in. I'm glad we're going to talk about this novel now with you. So thank you for joining us.
Actually, I've already been here, and I was away for 3 days, and now I've come back to prevent a disaster.
Oh.
You guys better run, because you're about to die.
I was wondering why you were shirtless and disheveled and carrying a weird bucket.
Oh, my hands are all burnt, and yeah, you'd think it was my puke bucket, but it's not. It's really my buddy. But my shirt's off.
Yeah, I wasn't going to really comment on it, but yeah. Wow. You know how to make an entrance.
Yeah.
I looked like a plucked chicken.
You know, sometimes I look in the mirror and I have my shirt off, and I'm like, ugh, I don't like what I'm seeing. But I actually feel better now after seeing you, Brandon.
Yes, I know.
There's a comedian. I can't remember who the comedian was. It might have been. Oh, I can't remember. But he talks about, you know, just quickly glancing in the mirror in the morning on his way out. Because if he stops for any length of time, he becomes like a football coach that just saw a bad play. Oh, come on. You're going out looking like that? Oh, come on. Yeah, that's how I feel. Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, we got to start by saying, you know, football is a funny game. That joke itself was kind of lame. You are my friends to talk about books. And sometimes when I eat dinner, I like to cook.
I like it. I'm more induced to do business with you now, I think.
Yes. It sounds better in my natural Canadian language. You know this.
See, this is so great, Brandon, because the last time I was on a show, Dan and I were on the edge with you, and you just finished eating spaghetti.
Yes, and now I'm drunk and have no shirt, and I have a slop bucket. These are clues for the book we're talking about. We're not just rambling on and on. These are
well,
clues.
A little column A, a little column B.
Yes, these are clues. Well, we are talking about Deep Space Nine, Fallen Heroes, and this book is an early novel that came out in 1994, in February of 1994. And this is back when Pocketbooks was numbering all the novels.
The good old days.
And so this, the good old days where you can put them on your shelves in the numbered order. And well, you can still put them in if you have these older books. But the newer books, they don't put the numbers on anymore. So there are no numbers unless it's like a little mini series, book 1, 2, and 3 type of thing. But they used to number every book. And so this was number 5 in the Deep Space Nine line. And so this coming out in February 1994, this would have put us in the middle of season 2. Mm-hmm. So more than likely, this book was written around the time of season one or after, probably a bit of both. And so my question to you guys is, when was the first time you've read this book?
Well, I don't know exactly when I read it, but it was pretty close to publication because I had it, I bought it when it first came out. It would have been shortly after. If I didn't read it right when it came out, it was within a couple months.
Yeah, I read this last week.
That was the first time?
I did have the paperback. I probably picked it up at a secondhand bookstore at some point. Just kind of like, oh, this one I don't have. Cool. But yeah, this was the first time I read it.
It's interesting to me because last week I was talking to Dan on the other side of the page. And I said, I was really looking forward to reading this novel because I think it's the first Deep Space Nine novel I ever read. So I went to my bookshelf and I saw numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, 6, 7, 8, 9. I was like, wait, where is it? And I've looked every, and I keep them all together and everything. For some reason, I thought I had it. I guess I didn't. I guess I didn't read it. And if I did, maybe I lost it, which I have a hard time believing because I'm so protective of my Star Trek novels. So this may have been the first time reading it. And so I had to read an ebook copy of it because I don't have the original.
Yeah, it's interesting. I remember it made like pretty big waves like when the book originally came out because it was kind of like a different novel and it was really shocking. And for a while afterwards, like it was known, you know, this isn't really spoilers because it's the plot in it. This is the book where everyone dies, you know, and it was an interesting concept and it was really exciting when the book came out. And I remember when the book came out, like I loved it the first time that I read it. We'll talk about later on my opinions and whether they held up or changed or whatnot. But the first time I read it, I loved it. It was the greatest Star Trek book I'd ever read, you know, and we discussed Echoes, you know, a couple of months ago. Like this and Echoes were the books that I held up as the high standard of Star Trek books at the time. Echoes was a Voyager novel. And, you know, I was obsessed with this writer. Like his name is Daveth Abhew. And, you know, he had written this, if you look at his autobiography in here, like I found the Asimov magazine that had this short story in it and found it and read it. It's called let's see if we can read it. The Coon Rolled Down and Ruptured His Larynx, a squeezed novel by Mr. Skunk. It was like this short story that was in this Asimov's magazine. I found that magazine. I read the story and, you know, Daveth Abhew has had a couple of other books. He wrote a Next Generation novel. I think it was called Balance of Power or something like that. It's a Romulan book. And I think he wrote another trilogy of Deep Space Nine novels, which I haven't read. But they're ones with the young Kai Winn in them. I haven't read those ones, though. But, you know, he never really went anywhere, though, after that. But, I mean, 5 books is still pretty good.
Yeah. I think the only novel of his I'd read before, I think he does the 4th book in the Fury trilogy, or quadrilogy.
Yes.
The Final Fury, the Voyager.
Yeah, you're right. I'd read that one as well.
And I think that's the only one of his that I'd read before. And that was a long, long time ago. I don't remember much about it at all.
Yeah, neither do I. That was the first time they did one of those multi-crossovers where they would have 1 book from each series. And I think he did the Voyager one, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, I can tell you right now that you both are correct. Because I'm looking up right now. I see a bunch of Deep Space Nine novels. Yeah, he did the...
Rebels trilogy or something like that.
The Rebels trilogy, right. There's 3 books in that, of course, because that's why we say it's a trilogy. And then he did a Voyager book, The Final Furry.
The Final Furry is a very different novel that we won't get into here.
The Final Fury. I'm so tired. The Final Fury, that's kind of furry. That was book number 4 in the Invasion books where they had the crossovers and stuff. And there was a Next Generation Balance of Power.
Oh, I even remember the title. It's number 33, isn't it?
Wow.
Oh, man, I remember that number.
You are so good. Do you have a computer in front of you?
Of course I do. We're recording a podcast.
So anyway, this book, so the main characters in this book are Quark and Odo. Now, all the main crew are in the book, but the main characters are Quark and Odo. And Quark receives a large box with a seal on it from that is of the Cardassian Empire. And he gets it from this Lonak trader. And so Odo is having Bashir, and then he's having O'Brien each scan the box because, you know, there could be something potentially dangerous in there. Something could explode. Something, you know, Quark, we got to keep you, you know. And Quark's like, come on, just let me have my box. And they scan it, and they say, everything's fine, everything's fine. And I was like, yeah, well, you know, you're going to open the box in my office. And Quark and Odo go into his office, and they break open the force shield, and they rummage through the items, and they find this little device. And Quark starts playing with this device, and then something weird happens, and it's almost like they kind of pass out for a second or something weird, you know, and everything. And all of a sudden, they find out that the station is empty. Nobody's around. Where is everybody? So that's what kind of starts off our story. So what did you guys think of the setup of the
story? Well, I like things that start with a mystery and they have to figure this out. To me, and I kind of thought this more as we got further into the book, it really felt like a narrative computer game almost, where you find all these clues and you visit these rooms and then you have to visit the rooms again and all that. And we'll get into the main plot of what they do later in the book. But yeah, this setup, I love the mystery. I'm really enjoying like what's going on, what happened here. And also the fact that it's Quark and Odo together, I think that was my favorite part of this book, was pairing those two characters together. And really kind of, it really reminded me of a later Deep Space Nine episode, The Ascent, where you get these two characters having to mm-hmm. work together on a problem, and they're, you know, very much antagonists to each other, and seeing them having to work together with from their two different perspectives and their very different personalities, but maybe not as different as you might think, you know, and that's kind of the beauty of these two characters together, to my mind.
Yeah, you had mentioned earlier, Bruce, about when did we think this takes place. Like, we had read the book The Siege a little while ago, which was the second Deep Space Nine novel, and there was a lot of references to episodes that had come out up to a certain point, I think up to Battle Lines or something like that. And this one here makes a lot of references to episodes all the way up to In the mm-hmm. Hands of the Prophets. There's several references. And I don't know if you caught it or not, but there are references to the previous books that Deep Space Nine had released in
yeah,
this.
Yeah, there's quite a few.
Like in it, they talk about, is it, when they're coming through, they're talking about, is it the Borg? And they say, no, not this time. And I mean, like, that's from the Siege that we read when the Borg ship came through the wormhole. And they make reference to Quark had changed some lighting after that big tournament that he had, which was the previous book, which was book number 4, the mm-hmm. big game. You know, so like it's interesting that they had this continuity in the book. But right off the bat, something that threw me off is this traitor came through the wormhole and he's got this Cardassian box. And I'm like, well, that threw a really big problem in the book right at the beginning for me, because it's like, why would this Cardassian sealed box be in the Gamma Quadrant? And it leads to this chain of events and whatnot. Why would this happen? Why would he find this in the Gamma Quadrant? And that was a really big problem for me in this book. Did that bother you guys at all?
Well, it was from a previous novel that you didn't read. It never got published, though. I don't know. I did occur to me, too, because I thought maybe we would get some revelation later about that, because I thought at the time, why is a Cardassian box being brought from the Gamma Quadrant? The Cardassians were never in the Gamma Quadrant until recently mm-hmm. when the wormhole opened. But I don't know.
That was and the box has been sealed for 100 years,
mm-hmm.
right? So, I mean, it's been in the Gamma Quadrant for at least 100 years.
Unless the traitor is someone who's been back and forth between the Gamma and the Alpha Quadrant recently and got hold of it, went to the Gamma Quadrant to do something, and then was coming back.
Well, except that, you know, the thing's 100 years sealed, and the thing that they find inside is what sets off the chain of events for this alien race that comes from the Gamma mm-hmm. Quadrant.
Well, that's true.
You know? And I kept expecting them to explain that away somehow. And by the end of the book, and you know, I don't want to get too much into spoilers, I guess, but, you know, we find out that the Cardassians have encountered this alien race before and they know they're from the Gamma Quadrant. And that part really bugged me, because they just kind of offhandedly say, oh, it was in the pre-wormhole days, so it took hundreds of years to, you know, travel back. But there's, you know, you'd think there would be some mention of this if there were a race from the Gamma Quadrant that the Cardassians knew about. Like, none of that made sense to me at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a big wrench right at the beginning that I'm like, what? But I mean, once I got past that, I'm like, I started to enjoy the story a bit more. But that right at the beginning, that threw me off, you know. And we'll probably talk about characters as well. But there's a couple of character elements in the book as well that really threw me off. You know, one of them is like some of the characters have like an overt racism and whatnot. Like even Kira, she's like, you know, like, why can't people look normal like Bajorans? And then in the next chapter, Quark's like, why can't people look normal like Ferengi? And he's writing it to be humorous, but it's like, I know that it's early on, but I mean, now that we know these characters so well, it just seems out of character for them to say these things. And there's something in here that Dax does, which we'll probably get to later on, that really, really threw me for a loop. I'm like, whoa.
The one of those that, this is just an aside because we're talking about it right now, but when Kira finds something in Sisko that she admires, and she's like, oh man, you know, his tall stature, and if he didn't have that disgustingly smooth nose, I better not think that way or something. And I'm like, okay, A, that doesn't sound like Kira, and B, like anyway, that bugged me. I was like, that's not Kira. Yeah. Anyway.
But that's also the, you know, what happens when you get these early books and they don't quite have the characters. But I mean, if he's mentioning, that's the only thing, is if he's mentioning season one finale, like this was written probably between the first and second seasons. The characters are pretty decently established by then.
And this was my biggest problem with the book right here. I mean, at one point, there were a couple points during this novel that I actually just had to like, okay, put the bookmark in and set it down and walk away for a little while because... And one of them was when Kira.
Because Rage Dan was coming out.
No, it's just little things that take me out of the book. And then I can recognize, okay, I'm not enjoying this right now. I need to just kind of like, I'm picking all these little things apart. And one of them, like Kira calls somebody a pinhead. And I'm like, okay, no, that just, it doesn't work.
Look, okay, so Dan and I talked about this on the other side of the page before we started recording. And, you know, I think Kira was just having a bad day. She has her moments. She was hungover. She was grumpy. She was just you know, and Pinhead was just like, that was like the word of the day for her.
And I totally don't believe
her. I can't explain that everybody
Quark
else.
Slipped a drink. It was totally her own fault too, right?
Right.
That's what they say in the book.
I that whole part, I just kind of almost have to leave alone because wow. Yeah.
Well, actually, okay, so now we're answering the question about the characterizations of our crew members that we know so well now, but yeah, after one season, I think you're right, Brandon. It's like by this point, you should have a pretty good idea of how they talk and what they would say and what they wouldn't say. And as you said, as we get deeper in the book, I think we'll keep revisiting this topic, but that is one of the problems with the book. It wasn't a big problem for me. It was just a few little things like here and there, like, you know, okay, she said Pinhead, it doesn't quite sound like her, but there were other times it sounded like Kira and so on and so forth. So it wasn't like a huge way off, like this doesn't even sound like this character through the whole book. It seems like somebody completely different. I never felt like that about these characters. It was just certain moments.
So the one with Dax really felt off with me. So it's in the book, like, and this isn't giving a spoiler, it's in the book when they're under attack and Sisko orders Dax out of ops to go and do something, and which puts her in danger. And Dax thinks in her head, I can't even remember, I wish, I don't even have the page, I don't have it open, but she thinks a nasty thought to Sisko, like, I don't see you volunteering for this, you know, like, mad that he's put her in this situation. And I'm like, no, like, I don't even, at that point, I'm like, I don't even know if this guy's watched the show, because this is Dax and Sisko.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if I remember correctly, wasn't it that she was even hesitant to go? Like, she wasn't even, like, he asked her to go do something and she wasn't going at first. Like, you know, okay. And like you said, why isn't he doing it? And then she decides, like, okay, whatever.
Yeah,
I guess
that,
I'm going.
That did bug me as well. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So we'll keep going through that. Although I think, you know, Quark and Odo were pretty good. Again, there may have been little things, but what they did is they found out, and now we're going to get into some more some spoiler-ish type stuff here soon, very soon. So Quark and Odo knows that the station has been attacked by invaders, and there are no survivors on the station. And, you know, we just mentioned earlier that this is the book that everyone dies, and this is where we come to find that out. Well, not everyone dies, because Quark and Odo are still alive. And they begin to realize that they have survived this attack because they have been shifted and thrown 3 days into the future, just like Brandon has been on the show. And see, it's all tied together. Everything that was said at the beginning of the show, now it's making sense. And but there's some really gruesome scenes as we go through this, because they're discovering the dead bodies of the DS9 crew. And I mean, they're like shot in the head. At this point, I would say, if you don't want to hear anything more, this is time to get out. But what are your thoughts about the tone of this book? I mean, it's very dark. I mean, a lot of people will say Deep Space Nine is one of the darker of the Star Trek series, but this is even darker than the darkest of Deep Space Nine.
Yeah, I have to say, there were some gruesome scenes and some darkness in this book. I would say it's still not quite to the level that The Siege by Peter David was. And I don't know why it just didn't get into as descriptive of some of the situations as Peter David did. But yeah, there's a lot of violence, a lot of, I guess there are a few, you know, the description of, you know, them coming across Dax and having two bullet holes in her head kind of thing. And, you know, it's pretty dark, but it seemed to work for this book. And I kind of liked that it raised the stakes that much, because when we encounter, first of all, Odo and Quark's reactions to this, I thought felt very real. And then later on, we meet a couple other characters and their reactions and the trauma that they're experiencing, I feel like made that story, you know, just that much more meaningful as well.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned Peter David, because I was thinking about him and his New Frontier series as well, because his New Frontier books are pretty graphic, and there's not a lot of really overt violence in Star Trek, and even in the books. And so Peter David's books have always thrown me for a little bit of a loop when it happens, and this time reading this one, it threw me for a little bit of a loop. Like, the one that really affected me was when they described Keiko. Like, the way that he described Keiko, like, the same thing. I think she was shot in the head as well. And, like, just, you know, the way she was looking. And I think with Dax, they were, like, her eyes had dried out and, like, shrunken and whatnot because they'd been left open. And a few other things. Like, there's a few other crazy descriptions that he did. And I don't know if we're jumping the topic here, but just reading the book again, it's like, it was a good book. But it's like, why are we reading this book where it's like we know there can't be any permanent repercussions from anything that we're reading? And so the first time when I read it, like 20 years ago, I'm like, this is great. This is awesome. It's something different. Everybody's dying. It's awesome. You know, and now I'm like, well, I don't remember the ending, but I know that it's going to be solved with a reset button somehow as I'm reading the book, you know, not just because it's the fifth novel in the series and we see the characters going on, but because of how the novels are, you know? So, I don't know. I might be jumping the gun on the discussion a bit here, but that's one of the interesting...
No, that's fine, because I think you're right. And maybe it probably doesn't hold up as well as it did back then, because we know these characters better than we did before. And so I think it stands out even more that the things the characters do and say don't sit quite right. And at the same time, knowing that we find out early on that Odo and Quark have been thrown forward 3 days in advance. So, you know, there's a time element. And like you said, there's got to be a reset button. So I knew early on, okay, they're going to somehow go back in time and fix everything. It's just a matter of when and how they're going to do it. So when you basically know where the story is going to have to end up and the characters aren't always feeling quite right, it just doesn't prove out to be a great novel, but just an okay read, an okay Star Trek novel. I mean, there's elements I really like about it because it is different and dark, but it just doesn't, there's parts of it that just don't work.
I mean,
right.
I never thought of that perspective that, you know, this coming out early in Deep Space Nine's run, like during the second season, it would feel that much more meaningful than it does now. So, I never thought of that perspective. Plus, add in the fact that we're now reading this after we've watched all of Star Trek Voyager. There's just a ton of reset button fatigue, I think. Oops, sorry. I just badmouthed
so
Voyager.
So, this is Voyager's
again.
Fault. We don't like this book.
Sorry.
Voyager ruined fallen heroes. So what else? We also get not just the storyline about Quark and Odo, but we also get flashbacks of what happened on that day with the attack of the station. And I like that part of the book, too, in the fact that we're, as they're approaching a different section of the station, meaning Quark and Odo, and they're seeing a dead body or something that happened, then all of a sudden we get a scene of what happened during that time, and then we go back to Quark and Odo as they're figuring those things out. I thought that format worked really well in this book.
Yeah, I did too. I thought that the past story part was the better, stronger part of it, up until actually when Jake, like as a spoiler, when Jake comes into the future timeline. But I did prefer the what was going on, because the author's really good and he is really descriptive. And there is some really great scenes that occur during the attack, like when the aliens. And I gotta say, did you guys not picture the aliens from the TOSK episode, Captive Pursuit? Like the way that their helmets were described and stuff, I totally pictured the hunters from Captive Pursuit. When I was
this was an
this.
Image that I tried to get out of my head while I was reading, but like an early description of them with the black bubble helmets, I kept thinking of the Spaceballs.
That's it. That's what I thought Brandon was going to say. I thought the
I
same
kept trying
thing.
Trying to get it Spaceballs. Out of my head because it is not menacing at all. But like every time they mentioned the black bubble helmets, I'm like, oh crap.
Doc helmet. That's where the Spaceballs come from, is the Gamma Quadrant. So they've come here to get our oxygen. Anyway, so the scene when these aliens confront Bashir was, I think, one of the best scenes. Just the way that it was described and, the point of view of Bashir and how he was trying to interact with them. It was really strong for Bashir's character, and I really liked that scene a lot. And the other scene that I thought that was really good was Sisko in the elevator shaft, there's some really great stuff that was happening in the book. And I think the middle third of the book was kind of weak because it's like, where is this story going to go? But it gets strong at the end and it's kind of a strong beginning.
Yeah, that's kind of how I felt. Like very interesting at the beginning with a strong hook to get you into the story. And yeah, like you said, the ending. Once I got there, it was page turning. I was getting through it pretty good. But that middle lull is a bit of a problem for me. Like it does just kind of, and I understand there's not really anything you can take out of this book to make the story, flow. But I just, it did seem to bog down and just kind of grind to a halt for me. And I don't quite know why that is, but it did make it harder to get through this book than it usually does for a Star Trek novel for me.
Well, I felt like it was just repetitive. Yeah. They just kept going through the station and discovering yet another crew member that is dead. And then even Quark and Odo to me felt like they were just like, here we go again. There's another one. Okay. And I was talking to Dan earlier today about the reaction from Odo when they discover Kira. And this goes back to what we're talking about early in the series and the characters. But, Odo's got deep feelings for Kira. But when they discover Kira, it's just kind of like, oh, okay, we got another one. Let's keep going. I expect like a big scene of Odo trying to deal with the death of Kira. And that wasn't there. But I'm going to excuse that because it was early in the series.
Yeah, we really didn't get the Odo Kira start until middle of season 3.
Right. But when you read it now, that's what you're thinking, right. But But yeah, it just felt very repetitive, just like me talking right now. I'm saying the same thing over and over again.
Well, the format of the book that he wrote is Odo and Quark would walk around a bit, they'd find somebody dead, and then they'd tell the story of how that person died. And then they walk around a bit more, find another person dead, and then tell the story of how that person died. And they kind of progressed through the ranks. Like, well, it's not like from the lower characters to the main characters. It kind of was. Like, they started with O'Brien. If I remember my order correctly, it was O'Brien and then Kira and then Bashir and then Dax and then Sisko. Mm-hmm. You know, so they kind of progressed up the chain of command for how the people died in that order. And I don't know, like, I kind of want to jump to it. Like, when they got to Jake, when Jake came into the story and he started to tell his experience of how he survived the event, I felt that the book took, like, a new level. And it became really, really fascinating to me in this last little bit. Because Jake is a young character, and for him to describe what he was seeing, you know, like things like Nog's sacrifice and, you know, basically knowing, like figuring out what his dad did to save him and whatnot. I thought it was really, really interesting. And the fact that he found Molly and kept her safe and, you know, reading this made me think of Newt in Aliens, you know, kind of like a similar plot point there where this young character survived this tragedy, right?
Yeah, I really appreciated that part of the story. And like you, I feel like the story really took off then. And I feel like either the author has some background in child psychology or knows a child psychologist or just did some good research for this. But the whole thing with Jake and Molly kind of regressing a bit and Jake just kind of automatically becoming a parent figure for her and helping her through this. To me, that was a really fascinating part of this story. And, you know, how humans react to trauma and tragedy and the things that we're capable of even during, you know, those horrific times, I thought was really fascinating. I really dug that part of the book.
I also like them talking about how Jake, this is really hard on Jake because he's seeing all this death and the attack and he doesn't know what happened to his father, yet, you know, he's still dealing with the things that he experienced with the Borg attack and the death of his mother. And this is like a double whammy. It's like repeating that all over again for him. And he's almost in this trance-like state of just like not knowing how to respond and still processing and still trying to deal with things, yet stepping in and almost into this father role with Molly and protecting her just like his father did with him when the Borg attacked them, their ship, with his mother's death as a result of that. So I really like that whole aspect of Jake in this book. And I kept having to remind myself how young Jake is at this point too. And that goes a long way too. And Molly's very tiny. I mean, she's not even 5, I think they said, or just all about to be 5. So these are young characters that had to deal with this tragic event.
Like, I picture this as taking place right between season 1 and season 2, because they make the references to in the Hands of the Prophets, I think it is, whatever the last episode of season 1 is. And I mean, like, they make a reference to Rumpelstiltskin in this book as well. And I mean, like, if Molly's really small in that episode, like, she's really young. And, you know, like, when O'Brien tries to put her back to bed, you know, she's like, you know, quietly nodding. And I saw that Molly when I was reading this, you know, because she did actions like that a couple of times too, where she was just like nodding with wide eyes and stuff. And it's like, I pictured exactly that scene where O'Brien's trying to put her to bed in If Wishes Were Horses. Mm. And you're right, like, the guy did a really good job of describing how Molly regressed, and I mean, you know, it's how she ended up wetting herself, and Jake had to help her out and get diapers for her and stuff like this, and it's we're talking about Deep Space Nine and diapers, like, this is bizarre, you know, but it was the part of the story that I felt was the most interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I don't know if we've ever seen diapers in Star Trek before.
I don't think so either. The last time I watched diapers on TV was Mr. Bean when he changed the baby and it, like, flew off the merry-go-round and, like, landed in people's faces and stuff. Mr. Bean is the best.
I agree completely. So, yeah, putting on my nerd hat, which inexplicably wasn't already on because I'm on a podcast talking about a Star Trek novel. But Anyway, if you go by the star date that they've given in the episode a couple of times, Jake and Ben Sisko scratch them into the wall at various points. This would be just shy of about a quarter of the way through season two, because it was 4723 something. So that would be a quarter of the way through Next Gen season 7/DS9 season 2. Which, you know, yeah, I kept having to kind of refresh my image of Jake and Molly and remember how they were back then. And there was actually one line, this is just kind of a total aside, but I was like, that's kind of a cool little unintentional tie-in when Jake and Nog walk past the runabout pad. And Jake says, or Nog or Jake, I can't remember which one, says, "Do you know how to pilot a runabout?" And they're like, "Oh, no, I don't." And then, like, if you flash forward to the season two finale of Deep Space Nine, if you could do one science project, what would it be? And Jake lights up, "Learn how to pilot a runabout?" Like, huh, that's kind
of... And then they end up having to fly into that episode as well. And like,
yeah, exactly.
I thought the exact same thing, too. I'm like, oh, the Jem'Hadar. Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, it's just kind of a neat little... Obviously not intentional. That episode would not have even, you know, been thought of yet.
Aired yet, yeah.
But just kind of neat. Like, oh, that's cool.
Well, these alien invaders from the Gamma Quadrant, and we talked about their black bubble helmets, and they're wearing gray and black armor, and they have these strange weapon guns that they use to shoot. They're very invincible. I mean, they're able to penetrate the shields of the station, and if you try to shoot them, nothing really happens. There's all this stuff, but they're going around, and all they're asking is, where is the other like us? And this is the thing that I kept wondering, is they kept asking them, like, what does this mean? Who are they looking for? Because if there was somebody walking around the station in a black bubble helmet all this time, somebody would have noticed. Everybody's like, I don't know who you're looking for. Who's the other? Somebody like you. And they're like, just tell us where the other one like us is. And I kept thinking, who could they possibly be talking about? So I was wondering what you guys were thinking at this point.
Yeah, fairly early on, I was thinking it had to have something to do with the device that Quark, you know, used. And it's funny that these aliens, they have such little regard for people who aren't like them, that they call humans and other creatures animals. They're not on the same level. But at the same time, that really curtailed what they were trying to do, because they didn't think to, you know, investigate more and ask more pointed questions to try and get to the bottom of it. They just assumed that because they got the signal from a device, one of their people was there, and these animals are hindering them from finding him. And that, you know, that's kind of where their thought processes end until our characters kind of piece it together themselves and are able to question it a bit more and get a little bit more information. So, you know, it's kind of interesting that their disregard of us limited their ability to figure out what was going on as well.
See, I had a little trouble with this plot as well, because, you know, I read this 20 years ago. I don't remember anything about the book. All I remembered with this was that this is the one where everybody died. That's all I remembered. And I'm like, it's obvious. Like, yeah, the characters they're talking to don't have access to the information that I have as the reader. But I mean, like, I was this supposed to be a mystery? Because I wasn't confused at all. I wasn't like, what could they be talking about? I mean, like, clearly it has something to do with this device that Quark activated. And I mean, so that's another one of the issues that I had with the book, is that I'm like, well, when are they going to find the box?
Yeah, it takes the characters way too long to get there. It does bug me when I'm ahead of the characters when you're reading a story, trying to piece things together.
This is different because we've been with Quark the whole time, and they all haven't been. Like, Sisko wasn't there when O'Brien scanned the box, and all they did was scan the box. They don't know what's in it, and they don't know that Quark activated it. They don't know where Odo is. They don't know where Quark is. They don't know. But with us as the readers, I'm like, well, it's not a mystery to me, so I'm like, well, we know what it is. It's the box somehow. Whatever it is, there's something in the box. What's in the box?
Yeah. Right, like, but even Odo and Quark seem to take way too long to get there, too. I don't know. It just, it bugged me.
Well, and that's the thing. The reason I kept thinking, like, well, who could this be? Who are they looking for? Is because, to me, it felt so obvious that it's the device that I thought, it's too obvious, so it's got to be something else, you know? Like, I thought, oh, it's the device. Well, but no, well, that's a little obvious. There's got to be something, a twist in this. There's got to be a character. There's somebody on the station, something where there's a confusion or misidentification or something. And I kept expecting there to be that twist, and there wasn't. It was what you think at the beginning. So again, going back to what we said, we know the character is going to live, and we know that they're 3 days, Odo and Cork are 3 days in the future and probably have to go back. Like, I feel like there were a lot of obvious things. Although it was interesting to read, there really wasn't anything surprising about it.
Yeah. You were expecting it to be Garrick that they were looking for.
Oh, that would have been great. Garrick with a big black bubble helmet on.
Doc Garrick.
He was just doing some cosplay, and it got out of hand. Yeah.
Or Garrick sees these aliens, and he's like, gray and black armored suits. Oh, I can do so much better than that.
He'll
come
add
to
a
my
cape.
Shop.
It'll be amazing.
Yes. Well, and then O'Brien figured out a way to get to these aliens and kill them is take the phasers and make them into grenades. Mm-hmm. But you can't replicate them because the replicators can't create, you know, the energy for a phaser. So they had to gather up every phaser they could and create these grenades out of them. And then Dax is making the grenades, and everybody starts making the grenades at some point. So, I mean, I thought that was okay. I mean, there was nothing exciting about it, but it was a way for them to... It was their solution to get to the aliens and kill them. But overall, that's not the thing that took the aliens down. It was Sisko. Sisko wiped them all out. Mm-hmm. He had his huge electromagnetic pulse from the fusion reactor that he set off after he climbed through the turbo shaft.
Electromagnetic.
Yeah. Yes. No, I, you know, the phaser grenades were an interesting kind of solution. I kept expecting, I do like the idea of an alien, you know, with this armor that's just so good, and the idea of it being totally reflective and, you know, causing all this damage to the surroundings when they're trying to shoot them. I thought that was a neat problem to try and overcome. It bugged me when they kept doing the same thing over and over again, though. I mean, what else do you do, I guess? But, you know, when they're trying to retreat and they're like, give them everything we've got, open fire. And they, you know, cause more damage to the promenade, I guess, because, you know, they know it's not going to work. They had it set on maximum and it, you know, blew out a wall because it bounced off their armor. So, you know, I was kind of annoyed with the station security for the first quarter of the book going like, what are you doing, guys? Come on. But yeah, it was an interesting solution.
So Sisko was also, when he was in the fusion reactor, he decided to get on the intercom system and send a clue to Jake that he needs to hide somewhere safe from the electromagnetic pulse. And I can't remember what he said. Wasn't it a quote?
Yeah, he basically
from something?
Kind of talked about the Bajoran sun god. And from that, right. Jake was able to figure out that he's doing something with the fusion reactor. And then he figures out what Sisko's doing with the fusion reactor and that he needs to get somewhere shielded from the electromagnetic pulse.
And that Molly knows where to go.
And Molly knows where to go.
Yes, so Molly.
Oh, my God.
Because she's heard her dad talk about where to hide during electromagnetic pulse.
Or the weepy cells. Something like that.
Something like that.
The weepy cells, which they really, she means the weapon cell.
So.
And then he goes there and they couldn't get in, but they were in the shadow.
They were in the shadow of the other one, the lower one.
Well, okay, you missed the best line when they're like, Jake's frustrated. He's freaking out because he can't open the door. And then Molly pushes the button and opens the door. And Jake's like, oh, yes, because O'Brien takes Molly to work with him. And it's like, what? Like O'Brien's taking Molly to work deep in this Cardassian labor camp? Like, that's what his station was, a Cardassian labor camp. Why is he taking his daughter to work with him?
Yeah.
He's protecting her from leprechauns.
Yes.
There's a lot in this. Like I said, this back half of the novel I'm really enjoying, but there is a lot of that where I'm going, okay, this is a little bit ridiculous. Like, I
it's a Gold Key
almost,
comic.
Almost like I don't know how Jake got Gold all Chris of Latin that from like. What Sisko said. Like I that doesn't it was there were a lot of leaps there, I think.
That was a logic leap that was a little hard to follow. Yeah. Yeah, that was a tough one to follow. But once you get past that, it's great.
That's the tagline for this book. Once you get past that, it's great.
It's great. This was my choice. This book was my choice.
Yeah, no, it's not bad. I actually enjoyed it. But now we have Odo. They have to get this like key thing to get the device to bring them back 3 days to the past so they can warn the crew about these invaders and so they can address it before any of this disaster happens again. And so there's going to be some type of key or something on these uniforms, but so many of them are these aliens that are dead, you know, their uniforms are destroyed because of, you know, the grenades or something else. But then they find he gives it into the fusion reactor and Odo starts to melt as he's gathering a key from when the uniforms. And by the time he's getting back to Quark, he's just a puddle of goo, which I thought I had no idea you can suck up Odo with a vacuum cleaner.
That was great. As soon as like they open the locker and he sees like an industrial vacuum cleaner or whatever, I was like, oh God. Oh yes, please, please. Yes. That was great.
Yeah, I'm like, okay.
I want to see Quark vacuuming up Odo. I think that's great.
And then put him into a bucket.
Gotta be a shop vac, a wet dry
then
vac.
And looking up on the internet, how do you get Odo out of carpet, you know?
Sprite.
I'm surprised Odo wasn't killed, though, because Odo was hot, like, he was boiling hot.
Yeah.
Mess of goo. That he's even, like, you know, going, like, destroying the bucket. He was like burning through it.
Yeah, Odo was so hot that he was melting through a bucket.
Yeah, I think they said it was a steel bucket.
This guy clearly has watched Terminator 2 multiple times, right? Because I was totally picturing the T-1000 in that metal plant at the end, right?
Mm-hmm.
When he's like totally melting. But I'm like, I don't think Odo's going to survive that. But again, it's also early enough that we didn't really know a lot about Odo at this point. So I can give it the pass on that one, but still, that's pretty far-fetched, and I was surprised by that. I'm like, huh, Odo is a hot enough liquid that he's burning through a metal bucket. Do they think he's going to survive this?
That didn't bother me so much as it. I was impressed that he was able to survive that. And I was like, oh, that's cool, because we haven't really seen, you know, what conditions would kill Odo as far as temperature goes. And I mean, we see Loss, the other changeling, flying through space and stuff. So, you know, extreme conditions. I kind of would have liked to have seen more of what Odo could withstand in the series and stuff. And just generally about Odo in this book, it does things with Odo that I really liked. You know, things that they couldn't do with him on the show. For budgetary reasons and that sort of thing.
Like that scene when he like takes his chin and like pulls it down and stretches it back.
Yeah, that was weird.
Because he's like falling apart. He's been awake for so long that he can barely hold himself together. Mm-hmm. Right? And so like he's sitting there talking with Quark and then he like pulls his chin down and then pushes it back up. And I'm like, huh.
Have you guys seen those pictures that René Auberginois has shared, like on Twitter and stuff, of him pulling the Odo mask off at the end of the day? And it's like stretched out and it's the stuff of nightmares. It's kind of what I was.
Yeah, that's what I pictured.
It's kind of what I was picturing.
Makes me think of Insurrection.
What's that, sorry?
Yeah, the stretch. Yeah. The Insurrection, yeah, the stretched like faces of the Baku guys or whatever. Yeah. Yeah, I was thinking of that too before you said it was about all the different shape-shifting things that Odo was doing that we don't see in the series as much. So, you know, that's definitely something you can do in a novel that is not as easy in a series. But yeah, then the chin thing, it's like he went Jay Leno on us or something, you know? It's just, that was kind of weird. So, but they did get back. They got back and they warned and Quark, well, I mean, Odo's in a bucket. He can't do anything. He's just goo. And what, Kira's like threatening Quark as always.
Okay, and it takes Odo 4 days to cool down. Yeah.
4 days to cool down. It took Kira 5 days to cool down, just so you know. But yeah, so Quark had to convince Sisko and the crew to let him talk to the aliens who just came through the wormhole to tell them that there is no other, that he messed with this device and everything. And they were just like, oh, okay. And they went back home.
Yeah. All right, back through the wormhole that nobody knew about 100 years ago.
And never came back.
Again.
Right? We need a sequel to this.
Do we, though?
No, we don't.
Yeah. No, that ending was, first of all, again with Kira. I don't know why I have so many problems with Kira in this book, but she is just so over the top. Angry at Quark. And again, yeah, maybe I guess she's hungover or whatever. But like, she threatens him with a phaser at the end here. And like, it's just a bit much, I thought. But, and even Sisko seemed kind of really unwilling to listen to Quark. But I guess he does look like a crazed madman, shirtless and probably burned from his ordeal in the Central Core and stuff. So I guess, but they seemed uncharacteristically unwilling to listen to him at all.
Right. I agree. Yeah, it was a little bit of a odd ending, but yeah, Kira was pretty rough in it. And it's like one of those things where you get those people that they like, oh, this is how this character is. And it's like, no, they're not really that way at all. You know, like you think they're that way because of things that they say and whatnot. But if you actually watch the character, they're not that way at all. And even at this point, Kira wasn't this way towards Quark. She'd say a few things here and there, but nothing quite like this.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, well, that being said, Brandon, what are your final thoughts on Fallen Heroes?
It's not as good as I remember it, but it's still pretty good. And that final third of the book is really interesting and really captivating. There's some really great stuff in this book. It's not a great novel, and it's nowhere near as good as I thought it was. And I chalk that up to a lot of, you know, I've read a lot better Star Trek books than this one. I recommend reading it because it's not a terrible book. You know, it's not terrible by any means. It's a fun read. It's interesting. And the guy's a pretty decent writer. And so I think for my final rating, I'd probably have to give it, 3 dirty diapers.
It's definitely a pungent rating.
I'm still thinking of Mr. Bean now.
Dan, yeah, what did you think? I wasn't hugely impressed with this novel. There were a lot of little things that bugged me. And usually when they're little things, they don't impact the enjoyment a lot. But they really started to pile up in this book. The characterizations was a big one for me. And some of the logic leaps that the story takes, you know, were a little annoying. I did, as much as the middle of the story tended to bog down a bit, I did like the way the story was told, where they would find something and then they'd show the past and like how that happened and that sort of thing. I liked that as a storytelling device. The ending, I really like the very ending where, you know, Odo finally recovers after 4 days and refuses to tell anybody what Quark did, which is, you know, really cruel, but at the same time, very Odo and very Quark, where Quark saved the station. He saved everyone's lives, basically. But Odo's like, you know, you can tell people if you want, but I'm not going to corroborate that story, which, you know, it's pretty mean, but it still made me laugh. So, yeah, by the end of this, I think I'm really wavering between 2.5 to 3 out of 5. I guess it kind of rounds up to 3. But it's a 50% novel for me. It got about halfway there for me, which, you know, and that's owed to the interesting way the story's told and some of the neat ideas that are brought in. But a lot of the other stuff really weighs it down for me. So I'd have to say probably 2.5 torpedoes lobbed away from the station with a tractor beam. I don't know how you lob half a torpedo away, but somehow they managed it.
Well, Sisko showed them how, because he plays baseball. It's like, you know, hitting a ball
with
a bat.
It's exactly like that.
Not exaggerating. It's
totally, the skill sets are, I would say, almost exactly the same.
I could see where this book would have played better when it came out. I think, thinking back to some of those early novels, Deep Space Nine and Next Generation, that early 90s, I think I would have really been into this book for various reasons, because of the, you know, wow, everybody's dead and it's dark and there's some time travel elements to it, and the Odo and Quark characters are really great companions and they bicker and that's fun element to it. I think I really would have liked it, but because we've gotten to know the characters better and they seem off in some of the things that they say, that kind of throws me out. And I think I did know where the story was going, so I was surprised there was no twist or anything that took me off guard. But, you know, I enjoyed reading it. I do think, you know, if you like Deep Space Nine and you like reading Star Trek novels, yeah, I would recommend this too. But don't expect, you know, to be blown away by it. And it's not going to be the best Star Trek novel you ever read. But it was enjoyable and it was kind of fun. And it's also fun to talk about, too. So I would give this 3 out of 5 buttons that Molly is pushing.
Nice.
And one of them is she's pushing Dan's button.
And she's pushing Kira's button. And it's really making her mad, putting her in a bad mood. Anyway, so Brandon, where can people find you online and elsewhere on the network?
Well, when I'm not changing diapers, you can find me here on the network with Warp 5, which is our dedicated Enterprise podcast. And you can find me over on the Fandom Podcast Network with a show called Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast, where we go through all of Hitch's films one at a time with my good friends Chris and Tom.
You know, as much as I love the later novels and the shared continuity and the depth of storytelling and all of that, it's sometimes really interesting to dive back into a book that took place during one of the series, you know? Regardless of our feelings on the book one way or the other, it's still kind of fun to return to that world as it was during the TV series.
I like to think, what was in the author's head at that time? What is the author thinking? It's like, oh, okay, this series just started. I'm used to, you know, TOS. I'm used to TNG. It's like, how do I write this and how do I approach it? And yeah, it's just kind of interesting to see how all that works out. And it brings back fond memories, because I remember reading books at that time, you know, and it always is amazing to me how many of these books are shorter than what they're now. Like, usually when we get a book now, they're a little under 400 pages, but back then they were, you know, somewhere between 200 to 250, maybe pushing up to 300, but they were a little shorter. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of fun to look back and think how they used to be shorter novels. And even prior to that, back in the 80s and 70s, they were even shorter.
Yeah, totally. Not to mention, you know, if you're doing something busy, like going to a Calgary Comic and Entertainment Expo over the weekend and you don't have a lot of time to read, I really appreciated having, you know, just a slightly shorter book this time around.
Well, it's been fun talking about short books, but it isn't the only thing we've been discussing here on the network. And here's a short and quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Warp 5.
I guess I'm going to be the one dissenter, because I saw major differences, maybe not in the way it was shot, but in the storylines. And I just thought, yeah, it's Klingon court, and that's pretty much where the similarities ended for me.
The 602 Club.
And I really love, before they go to detention, their principal, Bentley, saying, you know, you get one life, and you get to decide how you're going to spend it. And on top of that, Bravestone says to Finbar, he says, you know, it's a lot easier to be brave when you've got lives to spare. It's a lot harder when you only have one life. And Finbar's like, you've only ever had one life.
The Orb.
I felt like they found a reason for why Sisko would say, okay, I'll stay. Otherwise, you know, he immediately, at the beginning, was like, I'm not going to help you. I'm not going to get involved. Send me back to my universe. This is not my place.
Earl Grey.
Wesley and Patru pass by Worf's quarters where they hear screams coming from within. They find Worf is being beaten by Geordi, Tasha, and Data. There's more. Patru moves in to help, but Wesley stops him. He explains that this moment of humiliation is one celebrated by Klingons.
Okay.
So, and the script goes on to explain that Worf tearfully thanks Geordi, Tasha, and Data because being humiliated by friends makes it, quote, the finest humiliation he'd ever experienced.
Okay, I almost believe that, except the part that says Worf in tears.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. And you'll find us wherever you get your podcasts.
If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on iPhone, iPad, or Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app to get the latest episodes as soon as they're published. And if you have the time, please leave us a star rating and written review. We'd love to hear what you think. If you're not an Apple user, though, we've got you covered as well. You can find all of the Trek FM shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, YouTube, in most third-party apps. And you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link there as well.
And if you'd like to help us keep all the shows coming to you each and every week, you can become a patron of the network on Patreon. Just visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm to get all the details. You know, that should be a cheer. I'm going to make a cheer for that at some point. But the perks include early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and more available through our special patrons website, Patron Zone, and it requires a great amount. No, it just creates a great deal of money to produce, host, and distribute these shows each month. And so we really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. So again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm.
Well, we'd love to hear your thoughts on today's show, whether that's in written format or in the form of a cheer. And there are many ways for you to do that. The best place to join in the larger conversation is the Babel Conference. That's our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel. And I'm not going to do a cheer for this. I'm just going to say
P-A-B-E-L.
Into the search
field. B-A-B-E-L.
Bruce has got the cheers covered. We're good there. So just type that into the search field on Facebook and it should come right up. If you'd like to send us an email, you can use the form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Choose to send to a show and select Literary Treks. That will come right to us. You can also find the network on Twitter at TrekFM and on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. And word of warning, anything you say can and will be repeated on the show. So you have been warned.
Ooh, I love the warning there. Hey, and we'd like to give a big cheer to Norman C. Lau, Ken Tripp, Greg Rozier, Brandon Shane Matala, Justin Osier, and Jeffrey Harlan for their support of the Trek FM network and being associate producers for Literary Treks as well. So Dan, D-A-N, where can people find you when you're not being a puddle of goo with a key?
Well, that's putting a severe crimp in my ability to cheer for sure, but luckily I can still form a hand and tweet, so you can find me on Twitter at Kertrats, that's K-E-R-T-R-A-T-S. You can find me on YouTube. My YouTube channel is youtube.com/Kertrats Productions. You can find me on facebook.com/Kertrats Productions, and of course in the Babel Conference, usually lurking, but sometimes talking about Star Trek as well. Now, Bruce, when you're not inspecting alien devices and accidentally setting off catastrophes, where can we find you?
Kaboom! Show's over. I've been playing with devices too much. Boom. But you can find me on Twitter at Admiral_Rex. That's Admiral with the little underline and then Rex. And you can also find me on the Star Wars Report podcast, talking about, of course, Star Wars and especially recently Solo, A Star Wars Story. And of course, you can always find me in the BABEL conference. So thanks, everyone, for listening. And until next time,
live long
and read on.
You call that light reading?
To each his own, number one.